Well, before we start into our regular thing, I thought I'd share just one little thing from my quiet time in Isaiah 39, I think it was. You remember we I shared with you from my quiet time as I kind of read through Isaiah and some other places, but about Hezekiah, and the story always just has really impacted me that Hezekiah is here and they're in Jerusalem and they're surrounded by Assyria, and there's not much they can do. They're stuck, and this king of Assyria, this he is sly and powerful and deceptive, and he's just one of those guys. He knows how to get things done. You know, it's not the right way, but he can get stuff done. And remember, he was talking and he was speaking in the language that the Hebrews could understand, and so trying to discourage them, and they're telling, don't talk in that language, just talk to us. And so he's kind of just trickery. And then Hezekiah, he wrote this letter to Hezekiah, and Hezekiah, you know, it's meant to discourage Hezekiah. But Hezekiah takes this letter and runs to God. And he spreads this letter out in the temple. And he says, God, look what this guy is saying about your people and about you. Are you going to put up with this? Help us. And God delivers them miraculously from this situation. And that whole setting just always just like, he just laid it out. God knew what was in the letter, but he just lays it out and says, look at this, God. It's like us coming to God and just laying out all of our issues and everything. Look at this, God. Look at this. Will you help? And then Hezekiah, later he got sick. And it said he rolled over in his bed in bitterness. In bitterness he wept. And he was a sickness. He was going to die. He'd already been a prophet. Had told him, you're going to die. And he turned to God and he said, God, I'm not ready to go. And God gives him 15 more years. But you know, just because these miraculous things happen, it's no guarantee of the future. And Hezekiah started living for himself. And he showed all the treasures of the temple to a foreign king. And Isaiah told him, you messed up. What are you doing? And there's going to be consequences for what he did. But the consequences are not going to come until Hezekiah dies. He's already been promised this 15 years by God. And so the word of it says here, the last verse in chapter 39 says, The word of the Lord you have spoken is good, Hezekiah replied, for he thought there would be peace and security in my lifetime. What a punk. All this stuff God had delivered him from. And he still has an opportunity to repent. He has an opportunity to finish strong. He has an opportunity to impact the next generation for the purposes of God. And he chooses to go out selfishly. Chooses to go out selfishly. And, you know, it's just, and he said when he was sick, he had said, I know this sickness is for the purposes of God in my life. I know it's for, he handled the trial gloriously. I know this is for the purposes of God. Deliver me from it, God. And I guess it's like, don't waste. If God, you're in a trial, or God has delivered you from a trial, just because you glorify Him doesn't mean there's still benefit to get from it. It's so easy to then turn back and live how we always lived, to just live for ourselves, no matter what God has done for us. And so, I don't know, that spoke to me is we just have to be alert. You know, just because God has done great things in our lives and even used us in great ways doesn't mean that we're safe. We still have a tendency to go back and live for ourselves. And that's what Hezekiah did. When he had this opportunity to impact the next generation, he didn't take it. So, anyway, God was, I think, spoke to me in that. So let's move on to Firm Foundations. You know, this series that we're doing, I think all of you are familiar with it. And every single lesson that we do, it's like another block in the foundation that we're building and helps us to understand a little more deeply of who God is and what He's doing. Now, here's the thing, is one block may impact us and grab us and be more exciting than another. Even for us guys that teach it, we are excited about teaching one more than the other. But each one, each step, though, is critical to understanding God, how God goes about reconciling man to Himself. And if we're going to understand anything in the Bible, this is the thing we have to understand. Both if we're going to be used by God and if we're... Oh, there's outlines on the back there. So God is still in this... He's doing this thing of reconciling man. He's repairing a relationship. That doesn't mean that you've always known God and it got broken and He's repaired. It means for us, mankind as general, we started off with God, we got separated from God, and now God is restoring, He wants to restore that relationship of man to God. And this is what we're understanding, is this restoration of the relationship. And so as we go through, there's certain points that are just like stand out to us, like creation and the way that God made us in this perfect relationship with Him. And then the fall. That just gives us this clear understanding of the separation between God and man. And then that first death, that's like this delineating point to me as I read through Scripture, that really this point He wants us to understand, deeply understanding, that the punishment for sin is death. And if you don't understand that basic thing, you'll never get anywhere with God. And you always have to come back to that, because you will sin. I will sin. And we may take a few days. So, you know, we in teaching this Firm Foundations, we do it just a little bit differently when we do it in this setting, where most of the people here, are, you got to know the basics. You most people here are believers. And when we were in a different setting, we handle it a little bit differently. We don't give any information out. We restrict the information. And we give it as there's a need for it as we go through. But sometimes in this setting, we'll talk a little more. And so, these things are critical for you to understand deeply. If you have this full understanding, there will be opportunities you have to share one little bit of truth, one little bit that will make a difference in somebody's life. It's critical that you understand these truths through and through, if you would be able to share them at the right time. So, another block in the foundation this morning, as we introduce the nation of Israel and how God called Moses. Now, last week, you know, I think a critical point was with Abraham, and so there's a couple of things we need to touch on. So God made this promise to Abraham, and it involved four things. He promised that there'd be a great nation. So there's going to be a great nation. That means he's going to have a son. He gave these land promises, specific land promises to him. And so, and you'll find that people will tend to focus on one or the other of these things. The nation Israel, of course, many times they focused on a couple of them. There'd be a great nation and all these land promises that they had. He promised that whoever blesses you will be blessed. And he made this huge thing, this promise that the whole world will be blessed through your descendants. And so, Abraham did something dramatic. Now, you may be thinking I'm going to say about where he went to sacrifice his son, Isaac, but that's not what I'm talking about. He did something dramatic. And that is, when God told him these things and made these promises to him, he believed. He believed God. Do you know what God did? He credited and counted him as if he was righteous. Because he believed. Not because he had done all these good things. He hadn't done this great deed of taking Isaac over the mountain yet. But he believed God. And this set the course, this set the path for the life of Abraham. And of Abraham being used, really, to change the world. Because he did great. Because he believed. He believed God. And God counted and put into his account righteousness. And this is going to be something that's going to be built on throughout the rest of the Bible. So you remember, though, this story, this impacting, there's these things that stand out, these like these pinnacles that stand out as you read through the Old Testament, and one of them has to be Abraham walking up on that mountain with his son to go make a sacrifice, and they have the wood and they have the fire, but they did not bring a lamb. They did not bring... God will provide, Abraham said. They get on the mountain, and there's Isaac, condemned to die. He's tied up. He's put on the altar, and there is the old man, Abraham, with his life, his everything sitting there in front of him, the promise of God, his son, his future, everything is tied up right there, literally in front of him, and God's saying, plunge the knife into the heart of your precious son. All of your hope, all of your dreams, sacrifice him. And there is Abraham. He set his jaw to believe. There again, he believed God no matter what, no matter what, no matter how ridiculous, no matter how crazy, no matter what, he chose to believe God. He raises the knife to plunge it at Abraham, and God stops him. And there, tangled up in the bush, is a ram. And don't you know, and the way we looked at it, we added a few lines to the story of Isaac laying there about to die, and he looks over and there's that ram, and he says, Daddy, let that lamb die in place of me. And there was a death on the mountain that day, but it was not Isaac. It was the ram. He was a substitute. And God, in that dramatic, horrible situation, he wanted us to get a picture of something. Substitution. He wanted to give us that picture, and it cost. It was a costly, costly picture. But it was important for us to grab that truth of substitution. There was going to be a death. He was going to have to die. But God provided a substitute. And he wanted us to understand that as a foundational block in where we're going. So, Abraham did have this son, Isaac, and the promised deliverer was to come through the line of Isaac. And Isaac had a son. Isaac had two sons, Jacob and Esau. And Rebekah was their mother. They were twins. And Esau was like Cain. You remember Cain, who came to God, what appeared to be good, but he came to God in his own way. He had his own ideas. He was somebody that would be respected and admired. You know, Esau was a great hunter. He was an outdoorsman. He was a manly man. He had his own ideas about how to do things. He went out and did things. He took initiative. But he did things his own way. He didn't do things God's way. Jacob, on the other hand, Jacob made many mistakes in his life. He followed some of the examples of his parents. His mother was a little deceptive. And they showed favoritism. And he picked up on some of these traits. But still, Jacob wanted God. He wanted the things of God. And you follow the path, his life, the life of Jacob, and you see he makes mistakes, but he continues to move towards God in these things as he makes these mistakes, and he repents, and he moves towards God. And he comes to this point in his life, and we don't have time to get into all of this, but he comes to this point in his life, you know the story, where he meets this angel on the riverbank and he wrestles. It says he wrestles with God. And finally, after all this time, Jacob surrenders. He wanted God, but he was so stinking stubborn. Does that sound familiar to anybody here? He wanted God, but he wanted what he wanted too. He wanted to do it his way, but he wanted God. He was stubborn, and his life was just whole. He could have decided earlier, but God was patient with him. And finally, he came to this point in his life. He wrestled with God. And he surrendered. His life is different after that point. He didn't quit making mistakes. He wasn't sinless. But he surrendered his life to God. And you see some of the children that were born to Jacob when he was still a little more ornery. His children were a little more problematic, as his children that were born to his later in his years, they tended to follow God more. So here we have Esau and Jacob. Esau living for himself. Jacob trusting God more, one of the things that Jacob tried to do is he wanted God's ways, but so many times instead of Abraham, he tried to help God out by doing things in his own strength. He tried to help God out and connive and work things, but ended up, like I said, he did end up surrendering his life to God, and God used him. Now, one of the things is, as you read through the story of Jacob and Esau, you're going to run into this thing of polygamy. And I think you have to understand a little bit of the culture of this time. It was a patriarchal culture, and so they didn't have there was not like a central government. There was, if you wanted security, and if you wanted to kind of be able to eat through famine, and you wanted to have a more of a secure life, then your clan needed to grow, to have a little more ground, to have more crops, to have more protection. You needed to have a larger clan. And so, what's one way of having a larger clan is you have more children. You know, one woman can only have so many children, and so they started gathering more wives to themselves. And God put up with this way of doing things for a while. It was never approved by God. It was never planned by God. It was always one man and one woman. And that's so an easy thing to understand in Scripture if you'll go back and read the whole story. God tolerated this for a while, and then it came to an end. We finally said, no more of this. I'm not putting up with this anymore. This is not what I intended for you. I intended one man for one woman. And you should be able to look back and see all the problems that are caused by this and see, this is not the way it's supposed to be. It's obvious in Scripture. So many people have these questions about polygamy and stuff. It's like, just read plainly the Scripture and you'll see that this was not God's plan for people. So, Jacob, we know that he followed God early on. We won't go to all these verses there. Follow along your outline, though. Genesis 35, we know that Jacob, it says that he, after this, particularly this time on the riverbank when he wrestled with God, and all this, he built this altar. And he's made sacrifices. He made sacrifices to God. We know that he recognized he was a sinner. He knew there needed to be a substitution. He put his trust in God. He also knew, like his father Isaac and Abraham, he knew that the punishment for sin was death. That the blood, it was the blood that was required. And so there had to be a death to pay for sin. This was a principle that he understood deeply. So, here we have Jacob, the son of Isaac. Jacob had 12 sons. So these 12 sons became the 12 tribes of Israel. And the promised deliverer was going to come through one of those sons. It was going to come through Judah. So let's go to Genesis 28, kind of get us going here. And the promise, you'll see the promise is going to be renewed. It's going to be renewed to Jacob. Just like it was renewed to Abraham. It was renewed to Isaac. Remember that. Now it's going to be renewed. It's going to be renewed to Jacob. There above it stood the Lord. And the Lord said, I am the Lord, the God of your father Abraham, and the God of Isaac. I will give you and your descendants the land on which you are lying. Your descendants will be like the dust of the earth. And you will spread out to the west and to the east and to the north and to the south. All the peoples on the earth will be blessed through you and your offspring. I am with you and will watch over you wherever you go. I will bring you back to this land. I will not leave you until I've done what I have promised you. So, he's renewing this promise that there would be this one that would come that would deliver from Satan. What else? Sin and death. So there's this central idea that there needs to be a deliverance, that we are prisoners. We're slaves. We are slaves to Satan. We're slaves to sin. Remember, we discussed that. Not just doing things. We're slaves to that nature to go our own way and do our own thing. We're slaves to that. There needs to be a deliverance. We're slaves to the punishment of sin, to the eternal punishment of sin. All that those things come, so there needs to be a deliverance. Now, so here they are living in they're living in Canaan, which is the land of Israel. And at this point, with the 12 sons and their wives, and so there's getting to be a pretty good clan now. There's about 70 of them at this point. And but if a famine is going to come, and they're going to have to leave from here, and they're going to have to go to Egypt. Now, the story, we don't have time to get into the story, but the one son, Joseph, remember, sold into slavery by his brothers who resented him, went down in Egypt, became a powerful down in Egypt, and it ended up that he brought his whole family to Egypt. And so now we have Israel, the nation Israel, who Jacob's name was changed to Israel, which comes from the name of the nation Israel. And the whole family is in Egypt now. So, and they become a great nation there. They grow. They're going to be there for 350 years before things start changing. So they're going to be there for 350 years, and they multiply. A lot of people think there were at least 2 million, 2.5 million of them by now. So this is a huge number, a nation now, in Egypt, in slavery, because they had started to be mistreated, because here you have 2.5 Israelites in this foreign country, and of course Egypt's going, wow, this is quite a economic benefit to us, so we have all these slaves, but man, they're becoming as powerful as us. What if we go to war? They could turn against us. They could defeat us. So they become to be intimidated by this nation that's enslaved by them, and they begin to mistreat them. But remember, there had been this promise. We just read it. It was back in Genesis 28:15. He said, I'll bring you out of Egypt. There was a promise. Verse 15 of chapter 20, I'll bring you back to the land of Canaan. So here they are. We're in Exodus now. Exodus 1:9. So they came up with this idea of how they're going to keep these Israelites under control in Egypt. Chapter 1, verses 9 to 14. Look, he said to his people, the Israelites have become far too numerous for us. Come, we must deal shrewdly with them, or they will become even more numerous. And if war breaks out, they will join our enemies and fight against us and leave the country. So they put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labor, and they built Pithom and Ramses as store cities for Pharaoh. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread. So the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites and they worked them ruthlessly. They made their lives bitter with harsh labor and brick and mortar and with all kinds of work in the fields. And in all their harsh labor, the Egyptians worked them ruthlessly. But God still had not forgot his promises. So here they are. They've been in prison. They've been in slavery now. And surely you start to get discouraged. I mean, 350 years. That's like how long have we been a nation? You know? Yeah, this is longer than we've been a nation. They're enslaved. So, yeah, I'm sure some discouragement is setting in. It's always like this. It's like God just, he does these things. It's like it's past that point that we give him. It's too late now, God. We give him this deadline. It's too late now, God. It's too late for me to have joy in my life. It's too late for me to have fulfillment. It's too late. But God says, God has his own deadline. He does it the way things that he is going to do, and it's the best way. He's not forgot his promises. Exodus 2, 24-25. The Israelites groaned in their slavery and cried out, and their cry for help because of their slavery went up to God. God heard their groaning, and he remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. So God looked on the Israelites and was concerned about them. The time had come to leave, and God had a man in place to lead them, an Israelite named Moses. We're familiar with this, of course. So he was born to Israelite parents in Egypt, and he was born condemned to die. They were killing, you know the story, they were killing all the boys. So he was born in this, like in this hopeless situation, but he was rescued out of the river now. He was rescued, and he was raised as an Egyptian. He was educated and knew all the customs, and so he was raised in this Egyptian, high up Egyptian household. And then you know what happened. He became to be identified as an Israelite, and he stood up. One of the Israelites was being mistreated. He ended up killing the Egyptian, and he had to flee into the desert. So he had all this privilege, all this education, and now he's going to be a shepherd for 40 years. That's just way too long. That's way too long to be a shepherd in the desert. If I was in Moses' shoes, that would be about 39 years too long. But God had a plan for him. I'm just amazed. I continually amazed how God does things in my own life, how God does things in the people I see, about how God sees God does. It's like, you know, if I was going to prepare a guy to lead a nation of 2 million people in the most difficult and hard, I don't know if I would have planned for him to be a shepherd for 40 years. I think he needed an education. He needed all this experience. Maybe he needed a couple of hard years, the boot camp type thing, you know? A couple of hard years out in the desert, but 40? And now he's an old man? God does stuff like that. God's going to use this man, Moses, to deliver his people out of slavery. It's his picture. He gives these huge pictures. So, let's go here. Exodus 3, 1 and 2. Now Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the far side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. There an angel of the Lord appeared to him in flames of fire from within a bush. Moses saw that though the bush was on fire, it did not burn up. So Moses thought, I will go over and see this strange sight, why the bush does not burn up. What's going on here, he says. This is odd. When the Lord saw that he had gone over to look, God called to him from within the bush, Moses, Moses. And Moses said, here I am. Do not come any closer. God said, take off your sandals, for the place where you are standing is holy ground. Then he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. At this, Moses hid his face because he was afraid to look at God. The Lord said, I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I have heard them crying out because of their slave drivers. I am concerned about their suffering. So I have come down to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them out of that land into a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey, the home of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. And now the cry of the Israelites has reached me, and I have seen the way the Egyptians are oppressing them. So now I am sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. And God now has a big job for Moses. And what you're going to see with Moses is that it's confusion until he obeys God. And then clarity comes. Confusion, he obeys, clarity. That might be a familiar pattern to you too. You know, in the intellectual sense, when there's confusion, it's like, well, it's because of ignorance. You need to learn a little more. You need to study a little more. In the spiritual sense, when there's confusion, I'm not saying every single time, but usually it's because you need to obey in something. When there's confusion, there's something that you need to obey in, and then comes clarity. And you're going to see that over and over in Moses' life. You know, God is not afraid to use people. He's not afraid to use people in big ways to lead, to serve, whatever. And he will prepare us to do it in the way, and he prepared Moses to do this. And so, it's time for Moses to take a step. God's been preparing him for all these years, and now it's time. But let's take a look at his response. It's almost like, tongue in cheek, but like God overdid his job a little bit, you know? I think in earlier days, Moses would have been not just confident. He might have been a little overconfident. I got this. Yeah, I got this. He took out that Egyptian. Now I'm going to lead these people. Now he's a little different person. But Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? And God said, I will be with you. Nobody knew Moses anymore. He was not a common... Nobody knew him anymore back in Egypt. And let's go on. And God said, I will be with you, and this will be the sign to you that it is I who have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you will worship God on this mountain. Moses said to God, suppose I go to the Israelites and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me, and they ask me, what is his name? Then what shall I tell them? God said to Moses, I am who I am. This is what you are to say to the Israelites. I am has sent me to you. You know, I can remember so many of these things when I was, the first time I read these things, I remembered them. I was young when I read this, and I remember reading this. And just like, it's like, what? Is God being smart? I mean, it's like, is he, he's kind of the best attitude. I am? So, well, God is revealing more of himself to them. He is the self-existent one, that he is God. He is the creator. He's like making a strong statement here that when Moses has his doubts and when the people have their doubts, they need to not just look at the circumstance and think, what is God doing? They just need to remember who he is. I am the self-existent one. I don't need Pharaoh. I don't need you. I don't need anything. I'm going to do what I'm going to do. Follow me. That's what he's telling Moses. Follow me. So it's going to be a whole nother, that he does tell the Israelites this. He passes this on to them. And they go, whoa, this guy has heard from God. This smelly shepherd has heard from God. We're going to follow him. It's going to be a whole other thing to convince Pharaoh to give up all this free labor that he's going on. Let's go to Exodus 5, 1 and 2. I'm sure Moses wasn't looking forward to this. Afterward, Moses and Aaron went to Pharaoh and said, this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. Let my people go, so they may hold a festival to me in the wilderness. And Pharaoh said, who is the Lord that I should obey him and let Israel go? I do not know the Lord, and I will not let Israel go. Well, he's accurate in this thing. He did not know God. He had a bunch of gods, and in fact, Ken, I was going to make some copies. Ken had a cool chart, and I didn't get the copies made, though. But of all the Egyptian gods that they had, there was a slew of them. and you can trace a lot of these back to the Tower of Babel. A lot of these gods, if you could trace these, back to the Tower of Babel, and you can trace them all through around the world, a lot of these gods that they have. And so he had many gods, but he did not know God. There was the sun god, the storm god, the god of the Nile, the frog god, the gnat god. Well, it sounds silly to us, the gnat god, but it's the god of the dust of the earth. It sounded a little better to them. And so he had all these gods, but he did not know the Creator. And the problem is that, you know, he had no interest in knowing the Creator. You see, he had all of his substitutes and all these things that filled that gap for him, so he had no interest in knowing of this God, the Creator. If he was going to know this God, the Creator, all he could see was going to cost him something to know this God, the Creator. And so he had no desire. He's not interested in the Supreme God. He didn't want to hurt the economy. Let's go to chapter 6, verses 1 and 6. Then the Lord said to Moses, now you will see what I will do to Pharaoh because of my mighty hand, and he will let them go. Because of my mighty hand, he will drive them out of the country. And verse 6, therefore say to the Israelites, I am the Lord, and I will bring you out from under the yoke of the Egyptians. I will free you from being slaves to them, and I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and with mighty acts of judgment. So basically, God told Moses that plagues, trouble's coming. And God reminded him of his promise that he keeps reminding, that he had reminded Abraham, he had reminded Isaac, he had reminded Jacob. He's going to remind Moses of the same promise of a deliverer and of an immediate deliverance for them. So he had reminded him of the land promises. They're going to go, there's promises of a land that they are going to occupy. And so he reminded him of these things too. And verse 7 of chapter 6, I will take you as my own people, and I will be your God. Then you will know that I am the Lord your God, who brought you out from under the yoke of the Egyptians, and I will bring you to the land I swore with uplifted hand to give to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. I will give to you as a possession. I am the Lord. So you see, one way, though, that God is going to use Israel is that if you imagine a megaphone, God speaking through this megaphone to the world, and you can write that Israel on this megaphone is that God is going to speak to the whole world through this nation Israel. And so all these events and these things that are taking place, God is going to use Israel as this kind of this example. And so it's an honor and it's a privilege and it's a responsibility. It's all of those things. And so you can see, it's just like if I'm going to come up here and I'm going to teach, God can use that. It's not about me. If I'm willing, God will use that. But if I could start focusing on myself and become self-absorbed, and then it's about me, it's not about what God is saying and doing, and it gets all mixed up. And you can see this happened to Israel a lot. They start, God's intent was to speak to the world. It wasn't just about Israel. They began to fold in upon themselves at times, and it was just all about them. That was never his intent. They were a megaphone, an example, like this living example of how God deals with people and what it's like to know God and what's God like. And it was an example, a living example for the whole rest of the world. All of this is about that. So here we have this, we won't go into all the detail. The cycle begins where God would warn them, let my people go. He would say no. A plague would hit. It would always hit on another god. You know, one of their gods, that like the river god. Well, the river's going to turn to blood. And so all these things, all these plagues are going to take out another god. Now, his magicians would do, in a sense, what we've seen Satan do all along. They would imitate. So he could make a little puddle of blood where God made the whole river of blood. But so they say, okay, but they're as powerful as he is. We're going to just go with this instead of going with God. And so they kept making these choices all the way along. Epidemics, gnats, hail, locusts, darkness. And then it all was leading up to this last one, this most devastating. God spoke to Moses and Aaron about this very last plague. And you see, this is another one of those pinnacles. You have to look, God's going to look at this example. He's going to speak to us, to the world, through this example he's going to use. Exodus 11, 1 and 4. Now the Lord had said to Moses, I will bring one more plague on Pharaoh and on Egypt. After that, he will let you go from here. And when he does, he will drive you out completely. Tell the people, men and women alike, that they are to ask their neighbors for articles of silver and gold. The Lord made the Egyptians spend. So what they're going to, God's going to give them plunder, and they're going to leave. But something's going to, but there's going to be this last plague where the firstborn of every family, of all livestock, the firstborn is going to die. This is the final, the last straw. And God's going to provide them a way out. Remember? He's going to provide a substitute. Like he provided the ark. He's going to provide a deliverance if they will take it. So, if you look at chapter 12, you can kind of follow through. And I'm going to try to run down through this kind of quickly so we can wrap this up. But you can follow along on your outline. You can look at the verses here where, so he tells them they're to take a lamb. So here, the death angel is going to pass over every single house. The firstborn is going to die unless they do this. So they're to take a lamb. It is to be a lamb, a male lamb without blemish. They are to kill the lamb at the appointed time. They are to apply the blood to the doorpost. So just like the doorway like that, they are to put the sides here and the top. They are to put the blood on the doorway. And they are to stay inside the house, inside, under this protection, this blood that's been applied. They are to stay inside. They are not to break any bones of the lamb. And he says, if you do this, I will pass over. No one will die. You know, this is the craziest thing. When we were in Turkey, I can't remember the name of the holiday, but they kill a lamb. They hang it in the doorway. It's like, it's not exactly the same. Maybe somebody can help me out with this. They hang it in the door. You walk in the village, this mountain village, every house has a lamb, a dead lamb, hanging in the doorway. I don't think you were on this trip. Yeah. Hanging in the doorway. Hanging upside down. They cut the throat. bleed it out, and then they come inside. So they put this blood. They put this blood on their forehead. It's like, do you even? I mean, I'm sitting there going, do you even know what you're doing? This is like, I don't know. It's just like it was just amazing to me that they were still following. They were following this tradition, but had no idea the meaning of it. It was like, it was eerie to me. These lambs are being all over the place. They're going inside. It's like, whoa, you don't even. Anyway, we'll go on. So they followed through with what God told them to do. This outward obedience spoke volumes that they had trusted God. They were believing what He said was true. So consider this. What if someone reasoned that, why waste the best lamb? Because they would take the best lamb. Why don't we take one of the sick ones and use that one? You know what? If we're going to eat this lamb, it's a nice summer evening. Why don't we have a barbecue outside? We're still going to follow through with everything, but let's eat it outside where it's nice and we can visit with the neighbors. And you know, do we really have to put the blood? It's kind of messy, isn't it? Putting that blood is a little bit yucky, even for us. Let's don't put the blood on there. Let's maybe dump it out back. We still will kill the lamb. Do you think God would have accepted that? They would have been being like Cain. They would have been being like Esau, of doing things their own way, of what that was right in their own eyes, rather than the way that God had said. The Lord would judge them along with the Egyptians because they refused to trust Him. That's key. They refused to trust Him. They would be getting what they deserved rather than mercy. But now what if an Egyptian got to thinking, look at these Israelites, man. God is with them. You know, I'm going to go talk to an Israelite. I'm going to understand what I need to do. I'm going to kill the lamb. I'm going to put the blood on the blood. I'm going to stay in the house. Do you think the death angel would have passed over and not killed them? Yeah. Yeah. They would have been saved. They would have had a substitute. There wouldn't have been a death of one of their own if they would have followed through. So God said He would judge the Egyptians, and He did. I wish I would always, always, always believe this, that God always, always, always does what He says He's going to do. God will always judge sin. There's going to be a flood. There's going to be a deliverer. There's going to be a judgment seat. God always does. He's always done what He said He's going to do. Why would that change for the future? God always does what He says He's going to do. He's not like us. The Israelites experienced the Lord's kindness because they believed Him. When God came in judgment, He saw the blood was applied. And He passed over. But only because there was a substitute. Only because the lamb had died. It was this way from the beginning. God accepted Abel's sacrifice as payment for his sin in Abel's place. He accepted the ram in place of Isaac, and now He accepts the Passover lamb instead of the firstborn. And this became, you know, they still do this, you know, this is still a tradition. They still practice this traditional feast to remind how God delivered from death and slavery. Exodus 12:14. This is the day you are to commemorate. For the generations to come, you shall celebrate as a festival to the Lord, a lasting ordinance. They were thrust out of Egypt, and God kept His promise. He delivered them from slavery. So there you have another small brick in the foundation that we'll build on next week.